This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. And on this day in history, the Alcatraz prison in San Francisco Bay closed down and transferred its last prisoners. The 12-acre Rocky Island featured the most advanced security of its time and housed some of America's most difficult and dangerous felons, including Al Scarface Capone, George Machine Gun Kelly, and the murderer Robert Birdman Stroud. Many a film and TV show have explained and exploited Alcatraz Island's reputation, including Escape from Alcatraz and The Rock. Let's take a look at this iconic American prison.
In the 1930s, America was hit by a wave of organized crime. The FBI spent many years trying to catch and convict mobsters like Al Capone. When they finally arrested him, they had to make sure he stayed locked up. To contain this new breed of super gangster, the U.S. government planned to build a super prison. They found the perfect location, an island in the middle of San Francisco Bay called Alcatraz. On the island was an old military fort sitting in a deep pit cut into the rock. Workers demolished the old building and built three stories of steel-reinforced concrete cell blocks on top. None of the 600 cells had any contact to the outer walls. They were a prison within a prison. Each cell was fitted with unbreakable steel gates, which had no keys, but could be opened remotely. Alcatraz was the biggest concrete structure in the world, and supposedly the most secure prison on the planet. Bob Luke arrived in Alcatraz in 1954, looking forward to 12 years on the rock.
The boat made a wide turn, and then I could see the island. And first I saw the houses down the bottom, and then looked up and the prison was sitting up on top of the island. So that was my first glimpse of Alcatraz. It looked like to me like a French chateau, but I knew that this was no country home. This was going to be my prison for several years. Of course, we all had heard of Alcatraz. It was going to be the end of the line.
Alcatraz was the last stop for America's most dangerous and violent offenders. To keep people like young Bob safely locked up, engineers fitted the cell doors with an extremely tough kind of prison bar.
When they opened the prison up in 1934, these all were done over with tool steels. You can't cut these bars, even if you had a hacksaw blade. They're impossible. There's a heavy, hardened tool steel inside this bar. I used to come in at 12 o'clock at midnight and walk these tiers counting, and I always felt fairly safe, you know.
The doors weren't just unbreakable, they locked without keys. They gave a whole new meaning to the term, the slammer.
We've got 13 doors that we can open from this one box. And the officer would yell down the row here, rack them, just giving them a heads up that the doors are going to be closing. That's where you get the true sound of the slammer. Right! And this is part of the punishments of Alcatraz here in this door, open and close every day.
Well, the first time you hear that door slam, it's like being entombed. You know, you just know that this is going to be it for a while.
Right!
Alcatraz looked like the perfect prison, a concrete fortress brimming with technology. It didn't even need a fence around it, as it was surrounded by the icy currents of San Francisco Bay. Despite all the technology at Alcatraz, three inmates went missing in 1962. All that was left of them were three dummies made of soap, toilet paper, and hair stolen from the barbershop. And of course, the big holes they had scraped into the concrete walls of their cells with a spoon.
The cells are back to back with a corridor in between. Nothing but pipes. They crawl right up to the top. And once they got up there, they can't be seen. It must have took a year or 2 years of continuous planning. Kind of amazing how that was allowed to happen.
Despite a massive search operation, there was no trace of the prisoners.
I don't believe anyone ever escaped from Alcatraz. Most people don't realize the closest these inmates ever got to water was to take a shower. Now, you could imagine panic-stricken 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, jumping into that bay. No way. My impression is that if they got into the water, they may have got out 100 yards or so and then goodbye.
Whether the men escaped or not, the fate of Alcatraz was sealed. An investigation revealed that the supposedly escape-proof concrete was to blame for the breakout. Alcatraz used seawater to flush the toilets. It trickled from leaky pipes and seeped into the walls. Brick chips in the concrete soaked up the water and swelled like sponges, wedging open fissures. Eventually, the reinforcing steel bars started to rust and expand, and the concrete cracked even more. After 30 years, the formerly super strong walls were so crumbly that they weren't even a match for a spoon. The leaky concrete would have cost millions to repair. So in 1963, Alcatraz closed its doors for the last time. But the lessons from the rock live on.
And there you have it. A prison you know about, and now you know a little more about. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This Day in History, brought to you, as always, by Hillsdale College. More after this.
It was raining hard in Frisco. I needed one more fare to make my night. A lady up ahead waved to flag me down. She got in at the light.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we love hearing from Americans of all walks of life, and especially folks on the road, whether it's a truck driver, a taxi driver, or just sales guys who just hump it out day after day. So many Americans live their lives on the road, and my goodness, American military men, well, they're constantly moving here and there. I was the son of a military man. And today we're in for a real treat, and we're talking to a guy who calls himself Taxi Dave. We read about him in the New York Times. He got the full New York Times treatment. His real name, David Pollack, and he joins us from New York City. Dave, thanks so much for joining us.
Lee, thanks a lot for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you bet. Hey, let's start at the beginning of your story. Always a good place to start. Tell us about your childhood, Dave.
I was the son of a taxi driver, and driving back then was very tough. There was not a lot of money in the family. My grandfather came to this country from Russia, and when he learned how to speak English, he drove a cab. And my uncles drove cabs, and my father drove a cab. What was interesting was, back in the day, the cabs were actually like psychedelic colors, like bright oranges. They glow orange and they glow green and blue, and they were multicolored, not yellow as they are today. So when I was seven, my father took me for a driving lesson in his 1962 Ford taxi cab, 120 horsepower, no air conditioning. And that was the first time I was ever behind the wheel of any type of vehicle at seven. He was taking a bit of a chance. But what was interesting also, and I didn't know this until when I was older, back in the 1950s, a cousin of my father's was assassinated driving a taxi cab. And there were stories in the New York Times about it, and they never found the murderers. They left a .22 caliber weapon and shot him in the back of the head. So I reached out on my radio show. I mentioned it, and believe it or not, I got a call from a captain, a police captain, and he said he's going to speak to the Cold Case Bureau. And to make a very long story short, which it is already long, there was no evidence from 1955 anywhere. They did try to find it, and I was hoping maybe they had the gun for DNA with today, and just no enclosure for the family, you know, that the guy is dead or he was incarcerated or they have no record, but there was nothing. Anyway, it was very interesting because my dad bought his own taxi medallion, and our family car was this green and orange 1962 Ford taxi cab. So wherever we would go on weekends, it was in his taxi cab. When I woke up in the mornings, my dad had already left for work. When I went to sleep at night, he wasn't home from work yet. He worked 6 days a week, and the mornings he would go out to make money for us to go to the Chinese restaurant. That was our big thing, going to the Chinese restaurant every Sunday night. So I was kind of brought up, you know, grassroots taxi in New York City. And, you know, my uncle became a partner with my dad in the medallion, and that didn't work out. And then my father bettered himself. Actually, he was a member of a credit union that had loaned him money to buy the medallion and ultimately ended up running that credit union. So he had financial experience. And I know you asked about my childhood. Sorry, I'm starting to banter.
No, that's great. No, it's good stuff. And, you know, we always like to ask people about what got them into what they got into. And for many, it's the family business. And we learn that with a lot of families. So this runs deep, and we're learning this about the military culture, Dave, that so many guys, their dad was there. Dad was a cop. My dad's dad was a cop. And you know Garrison Beach out in Queens. And, you know, I've had a good reason to visit that little neighborhood. And, oh, my goodness, everybody's the son of a son of a son of a fireman. So it's just fascinating watching these things happen. Dave, you've been around the block, and you've been doing this for a very long time. What one or two stories stick out in your mind the most that you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, I drove a cab in the 1970s. And as you know, that came after the 1960s. It was a different world there, whether it was Rick James smoking a joint in the backseat of my cab. I mean, the most memorable I had was one evening, four gentlemen wearing Spanish garb, traditional Spanish garb, hailed me in front of the Waldorf Astoria. One had a guitar. One spoke English, three of them did not, and what had happened was a very wealthy person staying at the Waldorf hired them to fly in from Spain. He liked them in Spain, the way they sang, their harmonies, and flew them in for the night and flew them back. So I had the honor of taking them back to the airport, and I was serenaded in four-part harmony all the way back. I'll never forget that ride.
That's a great one.
That was quite memorable. And also, Andy Warhol. In New York City, you know, you have We're Creatures of Habit, same times. I used to love working Friday nights and Saturday nights where New Yorkers were going to parties, shows, bars, friends, as opposed to going to meetings and work and, you know, deadlines and stuff like that.
Yep.
And I actually picked up Andy Warhol twice. And to his, I don't know, I remember a townhouse on the east side. He invited me in once with his friend. And when I stepped in the front door and saw all the clutter, I just decided to step out and said, no, thank you.
Yep.
But it was interesting meeting celebrities, world-renowned celebrities in New York City.
And the real persona, you're not, you know, at this point, you're really meeting real-life New Yorkers in real-life situations. Tell me what you saw as changing in New York over the long time you worked on those streets, for the better and for the worse. So let's talk about the better first, and then maybe the worst second.
Well, it's really combined. Years ago, there's safety, and then there's structure. And let me deal with the structure first. An area like West Broadway was a cobblestone, double-wide street, two-way street, and it was known for warehouses and trucks. There were always trucks backing in and backing out, opposite the way traffic flowed, and it was all business and warehouses. I mean, today you have the best of art and shopping down on West Broadway. It's, you know, called Soho, south of Houston, Soho. And to see that, to see New York grow in that manner, and it's been very difficult for people who don't make a lot of money to live in Manhattan as rents go up, as places change. So everyone was pushed to Alphabet City back in the 1970s. You couldn't walk through those streets in the daytime. I mean, it was known as, there was a lot of heroin in New York City back then. A lot of people were doing drugs, and it was very dangerous, day or night. And today, I was down in that area yesterday. It's unbelievable. The restaurants, the clubs, you know, the beauty of the park instead of, what it used to be like.
Yep.
What could I tell you? And so, that's the structure. And as far as safety, check out the 40th anniversary of the movie Taxi Driver's coming up. And a few years ago, they asked me to do, if you buy the new DVD, they have some special things on it. And, I talk a little bit about it there. But on 42nd Street, it was amazing what it used to be like. Everything anybody in the country ever heard about 42nd Street, it's all true.
Yep.
And in the daytime, you had to look over your shoulder as you walked around that area. I'm not kidding.
No, hey, Dave, today, I came in from New Jersey as a young boy to that Port Authority. And my parents actually let me go to Madison Square Garden to go to concerts and to go to basketball games and hockey games. And let me tell you, we had to go with a group of guys, and you are dead right. I mean, you had to look over your shoulder that entire walk down. That was a 10-block walk that seemed like forever.
8th Avenue was very tough.
It was rough.
It definitely was.
It was rough. Hey,
and
Dave.
Today, yep. You walk by, it's like Disney World. Disney does have a few shows on Broadway, one of which is on 42nd Street. You have B.B. King's. You have Madame Tussauds. I mean, it just goes on and on, totally for the tourist. New York City is expecting close to 60 million tourists this year.
Crazy.
It's been going up every single year. And pretty much, they're pushing on 67 million by 2020.
Well, Dave, we'd like to keep in touch with you. We're growing a national show here, and we like to talk to people from every part of the country. And also, send us some clips from your show. Stay in touch with our producers. Taxi Dave has a radio show on the great WOR, one of the flagship stations I grew up listening to as a kid. Dave, thanks so much for joining us here in Our American Stories.
My pleasure, Lee. I'll speak to you again.
Thank you. And this is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. We talk to everyone here, and let me tell you, you're going to hear a lot of interesting stories from Taxi Dave over the coming days, weeks, and months here on Our American Stories. More after these messages. And this is Our American Stories, and we cover every walk of life here, from the arts to economics to business, sports, leadership, love and death, and justice. And it's an important word, and in many walks of American life, there's not only a perception but a reality about justice. And that brings us to our segment, which Alex Cortez, our field correspondent, put together on this very subject.
I'm a parent, a father to two little girls, And one of the things I like doing the least is reprimanding them. It sure is no fun. But imagine how it would be if the government gave me minimum punishments that I'd be mandated to abide by when they did something wrong. You don't have to imagine too much. This is our criminal justice system. It hasn't affected my daughters yet, and it hopefully won't. But it's affected Weldon Angelos. Lisa Angelos is Weldon's sister and best friend.
Music was a big part of his life, and I think he would have been huge if he never went to prison.
Weldon recorded with folks like Snoop Dogg. His dreams were in his grasp. And yet Lisa said he would have been huge, like it's a foregone dream. Because it likely is. His career, his whole life, as of now, the rest of his life, has been put on pause. His life story began here.
The neighborhood that we grew up in, we just ran across, you know, a lot of rough crowds. We didn't have decent clothes. We were on food stamps. My dad did everything he could to take care of us. And Weldon struggled with, you know, the fact that we were so poor. So he worked really hard and he knew he wanted to go into music.
But he tragically put his music career at risk. Although he didn't know it at the time, he couldn't have known how much of a risk it ended up being.
Back in 2003, he was arrested for marijuana charges and with carrying a weapon during the transactions.
The marijuana, $1,000. The gun, because it was legal for him to carry a gun, like it is for all of us.
He was a nonviolent first-time offender.
Think about what you think his criminal sentence might be. And then hear this.
When I heard it, he was going to be gone for 55 years, it felt like I just lost my brother. It didn't feel like, oh, he's going to prison. It literally felt like I lost him. Like, you know, he had passed. His two boys were 5 and 7. They were just destroyed. I mean, you could see the sadness in him all the time.
If my dad doesn't get out and he finishes up his all 55 years, he'll be like 78 years old when he gets out.
The 55 years was dictated by federal law. The judge had no discretion. The 55 years wasn't for the marijuana. It was for the gun. Under federal law, one count of possessing a gun in furtherance of a drug crime adds a mandatory prison sentence of 5 years. And every count after the first adds another 25 years. They caught him twice selling marijuana with a gun on his person, and they counted it as in furtherance of a crime, even though he never used the gun, no one was ever hurt or threatened, with a gun or otherwise, and even though he had a legal right to own a gun, 2 counts against him, 30 years. And then they found a gun in his home, counting it too as in furtherance of a crime. What crime? We'll never know. But with 3 counts against him, it's now 55 years.
Weldon's judge even said that it was cruel punishment.
And it was all a trap. It was a police informant who caught him. No problem with that, but after the informant caught him the first time, he intentionally went out to catch him again, and then invade his home, and find a gun again. He could have just caught him once and charged him. We're only talking about $1,000 of marijuana in total. Weldon Angelos was not some drug kingpin that you needed to rack up charges against. He likely would have learned his lesson after one charge. Now, he'll likely never have an opportunity to learn his lesson. He'll likely be dead when his sentence is up. That's not the mark of a justice system. That's the mark of an immoral system.
I think it's cruel. And, like, I'm not saying he doesn't deserve anything, but he did serve his time, and I think he's in there long enough. Like, the minimum should have been, like, 5 years, maybe. 55 years is way too much. Way too much.
At his 2004 sentencing, Judge Paul Cassell compared his sentence, 738 months, with the sentence of a kingpin of three major drug trafficking rings that caused three deaths, 465 months, a three-time aircraft hijacker, 405 months, a second-degree murderer of three victims, 235 months, and the rapist of three 10-year-olds, 188 months. He called Angeles' sentence unjust, cruel, and even irrational.
You know, it's not easy growing up without a father. There's always still that emptiness and the missing piece. It's kind of tough, but they struggled pretty hard.
I love you, buddy, and if I don't get a chance to talk to you again, I'll call you Tuesday, but I love you so much and miss you.
All right. Love you too. Miss you too.
Let me say hi to Jesse.
All right, here's old Pops. Sup, Pops?
Sup, little dude?
No, little dude, I'm probably bigger than you now. What are you talking about?
I know you are. How tall are you now?
Like almost like 5'10".
I seen the pictures. I'm like, oh, my kids are monsters. Be careful, man. You and your brother,
I know.
Be careful. And look out for each other, you guys.
Yeah, we know. We will.
Don't get in trouble.
There's only one way his sentence could be shortened. The President of the United States granting him early release.
Right now, we're just waiting and hoping for that call. Like, every time something happens, like, if I get a call from someone wanting an interview or wanting this, I have this tiny little piece inside that's saying, oh, they want to do an interview because they're going to surprise me and Weldon's coming home. And I know deep down that that's not it, but I always have that little shred of hope that that's why an interview is coming. Sorry. I'm sorry. I try not to tear up. Sometimes it's hard.
He hasn't yet.
I'll never stop until he does come home. No matter how draining it is, no matter how tiring it is. Because I can't imagine how much more draining and more tiring it is for him and for his children. That's what my father taught me. When it's family, you give everything that you got, because that's what families do.
And great job on that, Alex. And thanks to Generation Opportunity for bringing us much of this story. You can watch their full documentary at YouTube. Just type in The Story of Weldon Angelos. And what a story it is. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Mark Holden, General Counsel and Senior Vice President of Koch Industries. And he has a lot to say about this. He's been involved in the prison reform movement for a very long time. And it's an unlikely mix of folks who's involved in this movement, on the left, on the right, on the center, all over the place. One of my heroes, Chuck Colson, had brought me into prisons at a very young age. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And when we come back, the story of Weldon Angelos, and more importantly, the story of prison reform in this country. More after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we just heard the story of Weldon Angelos. We heard him say to his boys, look out for each other. Stay out of trouble. And sometimes that's what we have to do here in this country. We have to look out for each other. And joining us now is Mark Holden, General Counsel and Senior Vice President of Koch Industries. And it's the second largest privately held company in this country, and but one of the leaders of the criminal justice movement. And yes, these two things can coexist. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Lee, it's a pleasure and honor to be on your show. Thanks very much for having us.
You know, Mark, before we dig into Weldon's story, I wanted to dig into yours because you have a personal connection to prisons that tracks back to your senior year in high school, the end of it, and then your early years of college, but it's not the usual connection. Talk about that experience.
Well, I'm from Worcester, Massachusetts, and my after my senior high school, so first and then first year of college, and then after my first year of college, I worked on summer and winter breaks at the Worcester County House of Correction. And I got the job, I was a guard, I got the job because I lived across the street from a great man, Francis Degnan, who was the sheriff of Worcester County, and he had the ability to hire people on in the summer, and I was lucky to get that job, and I did it, like I said, for a couple of years.
And what did that teach you about some people who just sort of get caught up in what I'd like to call the system, and particularly about people in poverty?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I was working in the prison, it was a very sobering experience on a lot of levels. And what I saw there were a number of kids that I went to junior high and high school with, particularly junior high, middle school, who dropped out of school and I'd lost touch with and reconnected with them when I was working at the prison as a guard and they were inmates. And it was one of those experiences. It's similar to what President Obama said last summer when he visited the federal prison in Oklahoma, that there before the grace of God go I. Because these were kids that went to the same schools that I went to, same church, lived in the same general neighborhood, and they made mistakes, and they ended up dropping out of school, getting hooked on drugs, and then doing things that people do when they're drug addicts to support their sickness or their illness or their addiction. And they were, by and large, Worcester's a working-class town. They were kids that didn't have any support financially, and they didn't have strong parents. And the only difference I saw between me and them, quite frankly, is that I had strong parents who kept me on the straight and narrow. And, you know, to the extent I tried to stray, I wasn't allowed to, or if I did, I heard about it and felt it, if you know what I mean. And really what I saw there were kids that if they'd had a better home life, positive role models, a positive path. I mean, I always had to work from a young age, go to church, all those things. I think their lives could have been different. And a couple of them ended up being in prison. One's still in prison for life now. He graduated, so to speak, from being a drug addict to being a murderer. And, you know, that taught me again from a young age, to your point, about what it means to go to prison in this country. It's by and large, the people that go to prison in this country, it was true in 1981 and 82 when I started working at the prison, and it's true today, are mostly very uneducated and much more impoverished than the average poor person. That's who goes to prison in this country.
Yep. And Mark, let's pick up on the Weldon Angelo story we just heard. Do you think the president will commute his sentence, and why hasn't he done so?
Well, you know, that whole case is just, I mean, Alex did a great job working with the Generation Opportunity material, going through it, and it's just beyond belief, quite frankly. I think that a couple of things. The pending legislation in the House and the Senate on criminal justice reform, if it passes, and it should pass, will lead to the statute that Weldon was charged under, and he got the 55 years, fixing that statute so going forward no one else will, you know, who's a first-time offender will suffer 55 years in prison. It'll tighten up a discrepancy or a vague passage or something that's unclear in the statute. So you won't get 55 years. You'll get 5 years for first offense. And then after you serve 5 years, you'll get, if you do it again, you get 25. It's supposed to be a recidivist statute, but the statute's vaguely worded, interpreted in a way that was extreme, and the courts allowed it, and the prosecutor brought it that way. And so Weldon was convicted, and the judge, as you heard, had no choice but to sentence him to this, even though it was cruel and everything else. So the statute will be fixed and will be retroactive as to nonviolent offenders like Weldon Angelos, and there are many others like him in prison. One's too many like this, but there are many others. And if that happens, and it should happen, but again, Congress doesn't always do what it should, that would free Weldon. If that doesn't happen, which will really be disappointing if the federal bills don't go through Congress and get signed into law, then the only route would be commutation or clemency by the president. And we know there are a number of petitions pending to free Weldon, and we know that last month in February, Judge Cassell, the judge who sentenced him originally, wrote a letter to President Obama asking him to commute the sentence. So we're hopeful it does happen. We're pushing to get this legislation passed through the Senate along with a lot of other groups and individuals, bipartisan basis. But, you know, we don't know. And his life literally hangs in the balance. He's seen his children only a couple of times since he's been in prison when they came out to visit. And other than that, he hasn't seen them at all. And they were little boys, and now they're, you know, teenagers, big, you know, going to be adults soon. And one point that I thought Alex made a great point on was that, you know, the police officer, the informant, they're just doing their job, and Weldon broke the law, and he should be punished. We get all that, but 55 years is insane, in my opinion. But the problem is, with these laws, the incentives are all misaligned, because the reality is, you know, everything that we do in our criminal justice system should be done to enhance public safety.
Right.
And I think a lot of law enforcement, and they get put in very difficult positions. But if you were that concerned that Weldon Angelos had a gun and was selling drugs, why did you let him sell it three times? That didn't enhance public safety.
Right.
If you wanted to enhance public safety, you could have arrested him the first time. But they let him sell it two more times because the statute, the way it was interpreted, they could get a bigger bust and a longer prison sentence, which, you know, there are all these perverse incentives. I don't want to cast aspersions on the prosecutor or anybody else, but the system is out of whack, and this is just one extreme example of it. But there's many, many others that have been going on over the past 20 or 30 years as well. And hopefully the federal government, Congress, will follow the lead to the states that have adopted a lot of common sense reforms that have enhanced public safety, made people safer, made communities safer, reduced spending on incarceration, and help people turn their lives around.
No doubt. And what's interesting is, well, you've got this bipartisan coalition. I mean, you've got Van Jones and Newt Gingrich working together, and that's about as unlikely a partnership as you could see on the political spectrum. So there is room for hope. Can we talk about a couple of particular things and things I've witnessed working in prisons? I work in a church that greets these guys out of prison, and they can't get a job because they have a felony conviction. They have no money, and yet they've got to pay for their probation officer. And they don't know anyone who has money, and the people he used to know are people he could get in trouble with again. And I don't think we give some of these guys much of a chance at reforming their own lives after they've done their time. Talk about that, if you could, for a minute.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And to your first point on the bipartisan nature of this, it is bipartisan. It has to be bipartisan because we got into this predicament in a bipartisan way. As we know, in the 80s and 90s, it was President Reagan and then President Bush and then President Clinton. And Democrats and Republicans have both you know, really, I guess the best way to put it is no one ever lost an election by being, quote unquote, tough on crime, and they've all done that. But to your point, yeah, I mean, the system is set up, again, the people that mostly, where we were talking about earlier, mostly get caught up in our criminal justice system. It's a two-tier system, and if you're wealthy and you're connected, you're going to experience a much better system than someone who's poor. It's just the way it is. It's wrong, but it's just the way it is. It's immoral and inconsistent with the Constitution, and it's fiscally ruinous. But we could talk about any aspect of the criminal justice system that needs to be fixed. And then you'd think once you get out of prison, okay, you paid your debt to society, we should welcome you back. You should have your rights restored. But to your point, there are an estimated 50,000 collateral consequences to a conviction in this country. And it impacts everything from your ability to get a job that pays real money, to getting housing, to your most basic human needs. To get a loan, a license, to visit your kids at their school. We don't let people do that, and we don't differentiate between someone who's a violent criminal who's been in prison for 30 years and someone who got caught up in a drug deal and was doing 2 to 3 years.
Yep.
We don't differentiate often, most times, between those. And what happens is, I mean, it shouldn't be surprising what the way recidivism rates are when you don't give anyone an option. They've been in prison for several years. They haven't really probably learned any skills while in prison. They come out, they don't have any skills, and they can't get a job because they have a criminal record. It shouldn't be surprising that 60% or so of the people in some places go back to prison.
Yep, and it's costing everybody, and it's particularly in the lost opportunity and talent in those guys' lives and all the countless resources plundered by taxpayers. Mark, we want to continue this conversation, and particularly with Generation Opportunity as well, here on Our American Stories, Every Life Matters, and particularly those of us caught up in the prison system, especially if we have family members, and many more people than we know have people somehow related to this problem, Mark. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You bet. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And again, no part of this country's story do we leave untouched here on this show. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we love to look at the culture, love to see what's going on TV, and we've been following CNN's This Is Life with Lisa Ling, which is preparing for its third season of programming this fall, where the award-winning journalist goes on what CNN calls a, quote, gritty, breathtaking journey to the far corners of America. If you listen to either of our This Is Life with Lisa Ling segments from the last few weeks, you heard Ling's reporting where she managed to sympathize, literally, with the devil during her Satanist Next Door segment, and then with the notorious outlaw motorcycle gang, the Mongols. But today, we are happily featuring an episode that takes exception to her other Ling-type politically motivated programs. And that's what we like to do here, just give everybody a fair shake and a fair shot. This episode, called Fatherless Towns, centers around two fathers at a Richmond, Virginia prison who are preparing for a father-daughter dance hosted by the prison facility. Here's a quick look at what we're going to be spending the next hour examining.
It's early spring in Richmond, Virginia.
Nine creases up.
And Terrence Williams is an hour away from the most meaningful day of his life.
That's how I ever. Don't look good.
The city of Richmond is hosting a father-daughter dance for Terrence and 12 other dads.
Man, I feel like money.
But there's a catch. These men are inmates of the Richmond jail. And this dance will be the first time Terrence's daughter, Tekayla, will have seen him in 8 months.
How do you feel about the fact that your dad has been in jail?
It's like when he goes away, like half of my personality went with him.
There are nearly 2.5 million Americans behind bars. More than half of them are parents. And while fathers do time, the families they leave behind serve sentences of their own. The Richmond jail is hoping that connecting inmates with their kids can turn their lives around. But is one dance enough?
I never want to dance with my daughter again in jail.
That's very powerful stuff. And, you know, we spend a lot of time here with fathers and sons, fathers and daughters and family. And Lisa Ling does a terrific job. And let's begin our hour by getting to know Terrence Williams, the father of a beautiful 12-year-old daughter, Tekayla.
This is my sweetheart right there, Tekayla, turned into a lady. I was there. I watched Tekayla come out the womb, right? As I sang the song to her, that's daddy, baby, that's daddy, baby. I had to put her to sleep every night.
Do you feel like you still know her?
Not really. Not like I once knew her. Being locked up has crushed my relationship with all my children.
Terrence was born in Richmond and raised by his mother and grandparents. His father left the family before Terrence was born. Despite that, he says his early years were happy ones. He was a straight-A student with big dreams of becoming a professional football player.
I had offers from NC State, and I was looking forward to the next step in my life.
So what happened?
I was smoking marijuana a lot, drinking, hanging with the wrong crowd. And I failed two classes. I needed to play football. The first game come, they tell me I can't play. So that kind of crushed me.
Soon after, Terrence dropped out of high school. By age 19, he was dealing and using heroin, cocaine, and ecstasy. In his mid-20s, he started getting caught. And between arrests, he fathered five children.
How many mothers?
Four mothers.
How did that happen?
Now that's where the getting high and not being focused and no point play a part, being careless. If this don't wake me up, and then I don't know what will.
Well, now let's take a look at the backbone behind the father-daughter dance, the prison's real program, which stands for Recovering from Everyday Addictive Lifestyles. The program is for nonviolent offenders and aims to break the cycle of incarceration by teaching inmates many of the things they've never learned, such as how to be a good father, how to budget money, how to get a job. Quote, locking up everybody won't solve the problem, says Richmond Sheriff C.T. Woody Jr. The solution is to have programs that will help people change. The solution is to prevent the cause instead of treating the wounds. Here's a look at that real program, thanks to Lisa Ling.
The Richmond City Justice Center is home to 1,200 inmates. Jail officials say the vast majority are black males who never graduated high school.
Hey, fam, my name is Pop Hill.
Hey, Pop Hill.
All right, who brought us here?
On the jail's sixth floor, there's an effort underway to keep these men from coming back.
I didn't know any positive way except to drink or get high or run.
It's called the REAL program, a daily regimen of addiction treatment and high school classes. Inmates must apply for one of the program's 200 slots. Terrence made the cut.
What age does parenting stop?
It don't stop for me, for real.
And a couple of months ago, he was selected to join a brand new program, an 8-week course on how to be a better father.
If I'm out here selling drugs and my daughter, but she can tell by my lifestyle what I'm doing, how hard is it going to be for her to grow up and be fond of somebody her age who's selling drugs?
The 13 men in this room are here on a variety of charges, but all of them struggle with substance abuse, and each of them has anywhere from 2 to 7 children. Twice a week, they meet with Health Department counselor Clarence Harris.
What is the fatherhood curriculum?
Oftentimes, the men who participate in these programs didn't have a father in the household to teach them the lessons that a father should. They honestly want to make a change in the person that they were, but they really don't have a roadmap to do that.
So how does this exercise make us feel inside when we were working on it?
It's an environment where the men can get very vulnerable with each other.
I feel like I gotta change and do something different.
Mm-hmm. Was it tugging at you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Every time I think about my daughter.
Okay.
I feel like a part of me is missing because I never had my father in my life. Getting high. That's how I was dealing with it. But no matter how many excuses I try to make, the fact is that I'm not there for my children.
And when we come back, more on this remarkable one-hour piece of journalism and writing by Lisa Ling and her crew on CNN. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American. Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we've been following Lisa Ling's This Is Life. Sometimes it's frustrated us, and well, the last one she did was absolutely beautiful. Fatherless Towns is what the title was, and we were just following the story of Terrence Williams, and we left it off with, well, what a sad story. The guy didn't know his father and was trying to fill a hole, and we know this is one of the big and epic problems in this country, fatherlessness. Now that we've gotten to know Terrence Williams, let's get to know his family, most notably his daughter, who he will be escorting to this dance.
When fathers like Terrence get locked up, it falls to their wives, girlfriends, and mothers to raise their children. And 3 miles away, on the north side of Richmond, Terrence's ex, Kenesha, is holding down the house.
Hi, baby. How was school today?
Do you know a lot of other women in the same situation as you who don't have fathers of their children in their lives?
Yeah, I do. I do. A lot of the women are receiving public assistance, and most of the men are incarcerated. And even, like, when they come out, they're not able to position themselves where they can help their families.
Kenesha lives with her mother, Yolanda, and her 5 children, 2 of whom are Terrence's daughters, 9-year-old Takaya and 12-year-old Takayla.
How do you feel about the fact that your dad has been in jail?
At first, I was kind of disappointed, because when he goes away, like, half of my personality went with him. And then when he comes back, like, my personality come back. And I'm just always me when he's around. And then I heard that he was trying to get better and stuff, and I was really excited. I know he's going to keep trying so he doesn't go back in there.
How do you know that?
I trust my father, and I trust that he's going to keep trying.
Wow, she says, I'm just always me when he's around. So let's go back to that prison and see how the prisoners feel about the father-daughter dance that's coming. Again, here's Lisa Ling.
Takayla is a cheerleader. She and Takaya are honor roll students.
Get it, boo!
As they get older, the stakes will rise. Daughters of absent fathers are significantly more likely to drop out of school and get pregnant as teens. To keep their relationship alive, the city of Richmond is trying something extraordinary. A father-daughter dance in jail.
How many of you are really nervous about the dance?
Can I put 2 hands up?
What are you most nervous about?
I can't dance. I never danced with my daughter before. It'll be the first time she ever seen her dad in a suit.
You emotional about it?
Yeah, you could say that, yeah.
I was locked up when my child was born, and I was barely there, and she's 4 years old now.
So you don't really even know your daughter that well?
No, ma'am. Really, I don't know nothing about her, for real.
Oh, my goodness. Here's how Terrence feels about the dance with his daughter, Takayla.
I believe that building a healthy relationship with my children is important, whereas as before, I really didn't think about it. This dance is an opportunity for me to get to know my daughter for who she is and the chance to build a relationship and a bond that we didn't have in the beginning.
What a thing to do, and what a great thing to do for these inmates and for the kids. Now let's get to know Aziz Scott. As Aziz progressed through the program, the director of internal programs at this jail had this to say about him, quote, "He literally changed right in front of my eyes. No one can believe that this is the same person." Here's Aziz and his wife, Taya. Aziz will be escorting his precious 8-year-old daughter, Deandra.
At the Richmond City Justice Center, 52-year-old Aziz Scott is one of these men.
I first got locked up at age 14. I've been back and forth most of my life.
The downward spiral began with the death of his father, when Aziz was 13 years old. For most of his children's lives, Aziz was absent, consumed by his addiction. Then, in 2007, his life seemed to take a turn for the better when he met Taya.
This is my wedding reception, this picture right here.
They eventually married, but all the while, Aziz was hooked on heroin.
I was like, maybe I can be some type of backbone for you to help you. Then he was like, okay, we're going to do this together. And then a minute later, somebody calls his phone. He out the door. Come on, daddy.
Aziz got picked up for selling drugs a year ago. Without the income he brought in from dealing, Taya scrapes by with the help of her family.
Why can't you turn the TV?
I'll turn it up in a minute.
She spends most of her day caring for their 3-year-old son, Aziz Jr. But the housing project where they live is a hard place to raise kids.
It's every 2 minutes you always hear gunshots or you're seeing somebody fighting. The last homicide happened yesterday.
Yesterday someone was killed?
Yeah.
So how do you protect your kids?
Me and my babies, we stay in the house. I don't want to keep them locked in. I want them to be able to go outside and play. But this neighborhood can't do that.
Taya allows one exception. Her 8-year-old daughter, Deandra, can walk home from the bus stop after school.
You know, it's almost tough to listen to this kind of pain and this kind of situation, and we're going to keep going because Lisa Ling kept going and had just a real faith in these people, and in particular in this program. And we've got to tell these stories about these folks, about these kids, about these inmates, and we're going to here on Our American Stories, and we're going to do it a lot because a lot of our population is behind bars and a lot more are addicted. And I don't know many families who don't have some struggle with alcohol or drugs. And if you're that family that's perfect and doesn't have it, as Pat Conroy said, just give me a minute and I'll start digging in. So here's how Deandra envisions her daddy date playing out.
So let's see what you want to wear to the dance.
In just a few days, Deandra will reunite with Aziz at the father-daughter dance.
Pretty.
It will be the first time they'll be together in nearly a year.
Have you ever been to a dance before? Never? Do you have anything planned out for the night? Like what?
A big hug and a kiss on the cheek and the other cheek.
What has it been like for you since your dad's been in jail?
I miss him.
How has Aziz's absence affected Deandra?
She's just closed herself in. Every time I try to get her to open up to me, she looks like, I just want him home.
I just want him home. So let's go back to that jail as the prisoners prepare for the big night with their baby girls.
At the Richmond jail, preparations are underway.
You gonna tape the back out?
Yeah, tape it back.
Yeah, I'm keeping the curl. I need my curls, man.
The students of the fatherhood program are getting ready for something special.
Make me look good, that's all.
I got you.
The opportunity to reconnect with their daughters at the jail's father-daughter dance.
Make sure that y'all hold your seat for your ladies and have them to sit down.
The big day is tomorrow. So the jail has invited the butlers from Richmond's governor's mansion for a lesson on etiquette.
And napkin always stay in your lap.
So you don't put the napkin up here?
No. who's here that does not know how to tie a tie? All right, you take the tie, stick it over your head like this. Under.
Classes like this aren't simply a rehearsal for the upcoming dance. They're meant to teach life skills and develop the confidence of the jail's residents.
That's how y'all want it to look, that triangle.
This is how you want them to look right there.
These moments allow men like Terrence to imagine a better future.
I'm sure you've tried to do the right thing before. What makes this time different?
Me being in the program, I started to see things in a different light, right? The only thing that come out of getting high and selling drugs is jails, institutions, or death. And I've been in jails, institutions. The only thing left for me is death.
Wow. And it just gets better. And when we come back, we're going to have more from Lisa Ling and Fatherless Nouns from her This Is Life piece on CNN. It was just terrific. And it just gets more beautiful, actually. I mean, it's sad, it's tragic, but in the end, this will to get these kids and their dads together, maybe the only way for these guys to see that there's something better in store. Maybe this is the only way for so many of these guys to change their lives. More after this. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and we're spending some time with Lisa Ling and her extraordinary piece, Fatherless Towns, on This Is Life. And by the way, we had spent some time deconstructing a couple of her other hours, one where she tracked some Satanists and one where she tracked a biker gang called the Mongols. And they were odd pieces. We were even wondering what was Lisa Ling up to as she was depicting and showcasing stories she thought Americans needed to know about. But this one in particular, we are just flabbergasted by it. It was just so moving. And it digs into the depths of the fatherless problem in our country, in our inner cities, but I'm promising you in the rural parts of this country too, white and black and Hispanic, fatherlessness is cutting apart and tearing apart the fabric of American society in many ways. And you're hearing it right from the kids' mouths and the grown-up men in prison. And just a great piece of work from Lisa Ling. We heard how 8-year-old Deandra envisioned planting a kiss on each one of her father's cheeks. But how is Aziz preparing for this big daddy-daughter dance?
How has your addiction affected your family?
Oh, man. I was never sober for any of my kids. Never.
So when Deandra comes here for the dance, it's going to be the first time she ever sees you sober?
Yeah.
Wow. And by the way, again, this doesn't just afflict inner city inmates. I've got one or two of my closest friends who did not see their dad sober very often. Well, the big night has arrived and the girls are dressed so pretty for their fathers, and the fathers have shed their prison uniforms and are wearing a handsome set of lone suits and shoes. Many of them, as we learned before, who'd never worn a suit before, let alone tie to tie. Take a listen to the moment and hear how Aziz is feeling.
At 1:10, the daughters arrive.
Daddy, oh wow, somebody's excited.
They are moments away from being reunited with the most important men in their lives. Some of them haven't seen their fathers in over a year, so as you can imagine, it's a pretty exciting moment.
How are you guys feeling?
Good.
Yeah?
Waiting, we're ready.
Are you nervous?
Yeah, past nervous.
You all look amazing. Really, really amazing.
I'm hoping when she see me, she would call me daddy, come running to me.
What, they coming in right now?
Yeah.
30 seconds, she said.
30 seconds. Am I scared? Yeah. But it's something I want, something I need.
Wow, so this man is scared, but a good kind of scared, not the kind of scared he's known most of his life. And that was Aziz we were hearing from. And again, he says he's scared, but it's what he needs. And don't we all? And now we pick up right after the fathers and daughters meet. Not all the daughters are embracing this moment.
After months apart, these men and their children will spend the next 3 hours together. But despite everyone's initial excitement, at first, things feel a little awkward.
For some of the fathers and daughters, it's like no time has elapsed and they're having a great time. There are some who are just kind of sitting there and not being that communicative with each other. But when you think about it, some of these daughters don't even know their fathers.
Okay.
For 25-year-old Guy and his 4-year-old daughter, Diamond, the moment is overwhelming. The jail calls her mom to take her home.
All right, excuse us.
So it wasn't so clean, it wasn't so simple. And for some of these kids, it was just real trauma, reminding them of what they didn't have and never had. And some of them may be thinking they'll never have them. And for anyone who's ever tried to help in these situations where there are just terrific structural family problems, sometimes the help doesn't help. Sometimes it drives people into a new reality that they think will never be their own. And they run back. I had spent a lot of time myself in Newark, New Jersey. My dad sort of pushed me there as a ball player and an athlete. And I just got to know a lot of families there. And Sometimes there was just nothing to do. These guys, some of them just had to run. And bless Lisa Ling for going in and running into this story and bringing a camera crew and, well, tracking this father-daughter dance in a prison in Richmond, of all places, in Richmond, Virginia. Let's see how that dance is going that Lisa Ling and her crew were covering.
With just an hour left, the dance is in full swing. While most of the fathers and daughters are on the floor, one pair hangs back.
Trying to get her to dance? No, I want to stay with you. I go play with the little girls. No, I want to stay with you. So like she was trying to hold on and just spend as much time with me as she can.
For a brief moment, these 13 men can forget where they are and what they've done to get here. Their daughters can pretend that their families are like everyone else's. But the fairy tale can't last, and the memories they make here tonight will have to carry them through the months of separation still ahead.
And you can only think as you're watching this, and, you know, Greg, I want your take on this, but, you know, you're probably thinking, my goodness, if there's one thing to live for now, and you always wonder, what do these guys do there day to day to get them through? These are tough circumstances in these prisons. For anyone who's ever visited any relative in prison, I have. It's tough. And you're always wondering, are they going to make it? And then when they make it, they've got these felony records. They've got employers looking at them unfavorably. Their own family even wondering, and at a certain level, after a second and a third offense, wondering themselves whether they're going to make it. And all of this self-doubt, all of these problems just come crashing down. And again, this is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And this hour we are spending with Lisa Ling and the CNN crew who did this remarkable report from a Richmond prison and a program in which they try and connect dads and daughters through a daddy-daughter dance. I mean, this is stuff that almost all of us who are fathers take as routine, a daddy-daughter dance. Getting dressed up and taking your little girl out. But for these guys, well, we heard it from one of them. He was afraid. And you watched a bunch of guys with another guy holding a tie up and saying, how many of you guys know how to tie this? So the dance is winding down, but the fathers have a parting gift for their daughters.
I need all the fathers on one side of the carpet and all the daughters on the other side. Make sure your daughter lines up across from you, okay?
At the Richmond jail, the dance is coming to an end, and the fathers are leaving their daughters with a parting gift.
This line that we're forming here is called a line of commitment. On the mirror, you write what you want your daughter to see and know, her self-worth, her value, how precious she is. As she looks into that mirror, you know, this is how my daddy sees me, so this is what I know I am.
I know in this world that is crazy that you need somebody to protect you and love you. No one in this world is going to protect you and love you like I will.
I love you, Papi.
I love you too, baby. Oh, man, I'm prepared for this. Be home soon. Promise not to miss any more birthdays.
Okay.
Love you.
Love you too.
And that's, well, that says all that you need to hear. When we come back, more from Lisa Ling and Fatherless Towns. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and we return to This Is Life with Lisa Ling and her extraordinary piece of reporting on fatherless towns. And we'd sort of had a a few things to say about a couple of her other hours, and periodically we like to chase down different aspects of our culture, different shows. We like to celebrate them, periodically criticize them. We want to hear from you. We give you our opinions and takes on some of these shows. And, well, Lisa, a couple of weeks ago, we covered her Satanist Next Door episode, and it was bizarre. And then we covered her Notorious Outlaw Motorcycle Gang coverage of the Mongols, and it was even more bizarre. And so we were wondering what the heck Lisa Ling and CNN were up to. But then we stumbled upon this. And you know what? Sometimes you just have to say, well, she got it right. We didn't like where she was headed sometimes, but other times, my goodness, just terrific reporting. And so I wanted to go back to that clip you just heard. I want to set it up again because we're at this dance with these prisoners and their daughters in Richmond, Virginia. And the dance is winding down, and here's one father's parting gift, well, for their daughters.
I need all the fathers on one side of the carpet and all the daughters on the other side. Make sure your daughter lines up across from you, okay?
At the Richmond jail, the dance is coming to an end, and the fathers are leaving their daughters with a parting gift.
This line that we're forming here is called a line of commitment. On the mirror, you write what you want your daughter to see and know. Her self-worth, her value, how precious she is. And she looks into that mirror. You know, this is how my daddy sees me. So this is what I know I am.
I know in this world that is crazy that you need somebody to protect you and love you. No one in this world is going to protect you and love you like I will.
I love you, Papi.
I love you, too, baby. Oh, man, I'm prepared for this. Be home soon. Promise not to miss any more birthdays.
Okay.
Love you.
Love you, too.
And here's Aziz, who we met earlier, saying goodbye to his 8-year-old daughter, Deandra.
Come here, little mama. Don't do that. You know you mean the world to me, right? Just be good. Look after mommy. I'll be home soon. If you ever need anything, just let me know. And I promise, once I get home, I'll never leave your side. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And here's Terrence, who we met earlier, saying goodbye to 12-year-old daughter, to Kayla.
My baby.
I wrote a little poem for you. To Kayla, say me without you is like a sun with no sky, a bird that can't fly. A river that runs dry, and dreams with no track. Me without you is like icing with no cake, patience with no weight, and destiny with no fate. The fact is, to Kayla, there is no me without you. No that.
I'll always be that for you, okay?
There's no me without you, Terrence says to his little girl. After those formal goodbyes, Aziz and Deandra are sitting over in the corner, and picture them, if you can, holding each other tight, and they're struggling to let each other go.
It's the hard part.
How?
Because you're gone. Wish I was gone with you. I'll be home soon.
Okay, you about to cry. What?
I miss you.
And you can see the disease is visibly emotional when you're watching this, and you can hear it too. And his daughter, well, she can see and hear it as well. And this episode, it closed, like all of them do, with a final thought and final thoughts from Lisa Ling herself.
There were so many moments today when I totally forgot I was in a jail. It was just a group of fathers and their daughters laughing together, crying together.
Back to reality.
The thing that got me was every time I looked in, Aziz's direction. I just saw Deandra just holding him, like she just didn't want to let him go. You know, it was obviously so emotional for both the fathers and their daughters, but I just, you know, I hope for the sake of these little girls that these men keep their word.
The reality is that nationwide, nearly 80% of drug offenders will eventually be reincarcerated. The hope is that experiences like this can inspire these men to stay out for good.
I hope for the sake of these little girls that these men keep their words. And then came those really depressing statistics. And this really, strangely, both depressing but uplifting hour. Because in the end, it gave you some hope for these guys, because the guys actually had something to live for. Maybe for the first time, they really thought about it. You could tell. Terrence Williams, it turns out, will be released in July 2016. Until then, he'll continue to be a part of the fatherhood program. Aziz Scott, he returned home in August of 2015, just in time to walk Deandra to her first day of third grade. Aziz also got a job as a painter. By the way, he's quite a writer. I mean, what he wrote to his little girl was just beautiful. Then just recently, Aziz, his wife Taya, and daughter Deandra appeared on the highly successful daytime television show hosted by none other than Steve Harvey. And we want to play you a piece of that appearance and how it ended.
Now, Aziz, I know that your wife's been holding down the family, but we know you guys could use some help here. So I'm a spokesperson now for a company called Green Dot, and we're going to give your family $5,000 on a Green Dot reloadable prepaid card. This is it right here, man. And that'll help you out. Let me give you a personal thing. What I think maybe you should consider doing with this $5,000. I would take this as an opportunity to move. You got a job, man. You're out there painting. Take your family. Get them out the hood. Just move them to a safer place. Because it really struck me, something as simple as getting the cable TV turned on so they could just watch TV and stay in the house so they don't go outside in the unsafe conditions. The average person don't even have to worry about that. Just a safer place where your kids can just go outside somewhere, man, yeah. In a double unit dwelling, man. And just take this money, man, and turn yourself around. Your little girl is feeling you, man. I'm feeling you. I was crying so hard watching the show, man. You can't watch this without being emotional, not if you're a human being. You just can't. And I respect you so much, man, for climbing back up and pulling yourself together, man.
And those awes were coming from the audience, and it was the reaction, Aziz's daughter Deandra wiping away streaming tears as he embraces her. Well, it's a great ending so far, but Steve Harvey's right in the end. These neighborhoods, I mean, you know, imagine hearing something like that. I heard it over and over again. Well, you know, every home in Newark that I entered had bars on it. I'll never forget one scene. I started taking pictures in the almost 2.5 years I spent almost continually in the hood. And I actually was trying to write a book at the time called White Like Me, because it so took me that this place, and it so stripped me of any preconceptions about the people living there, that I just started working in the city. I started getting to know the people in that place. I substitute taught in a Newark public school. You name it. I just spent my time there. And I started taking pictures of the things. And here are the things that really struck me. A telephone booth, back when there were ones. There were locks all over it. And none of them worked because they were all busted into. Glass in any of the institutions in Newark, they weren't glass. They were plexi because the glasses were going to be busted. And none of the buildings had normal light. The smells of Newark and the gunshots and then the choppers overhead at night. And how do you explain all that, that ecosystem, to kids? Plus the street corners and the drinking and just always groups of guys hanging out at any time of the day. Doing nothing, except maybe, well, maybe being up to no good. And almost no fathers. I mean, the city at the time that I was doing this, and this was in the mid-90s, was hitting 85% out of wedlock birth rate. And that's just really tough. And the consequences are brutal for these young people. Terrible schools, very few options, and getting out was the way. And I know my dad inspired me and quite a number of men to get so many guys to just get in the Army, join the Marines, and get out of Dodge, and then get a free education, and just don't come back. It's just too rough. Great work by Lisa Ling on this. And when folks in the media do good things, we like to point them out here on Our American Stories. Fatherless Towns, CNN's This Is Life. And it is life. It's a tough hour to get through. But hopefully we moved you, and we want to do more of this reporting from the streets of our inner cities. And also lots of rural America that are suffering. It's a part of the fabric of this country, and we will not ignore those stories. Lee Habib here, Our American Stories. Great work on this, Greg.